Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, bursting through an igloo and onto the ice here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cove.
And with us today is Bart Nickerson, one of the head writers, I'm just going to say it, of Dispatches from Elsewhere, and a writer on Narcos, and also the creator of the Bart Principle, which he created and is not about him. Which states, as you should know, the average person is average at their job. Bart, thank you for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me. And thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to rewatch, like, just a fine, fine, incredible movie.
Rewatch, I had never seen it before. Had you seen it before, Kenny?
Yeah. No, there's something about this movie, even though I'm a big time sports film aficionado, that never grabbed me and grabbed me by the, you know, the hockey sweater and said, watch me. But I did now, you know, podcast like a 1999 did it. And yeah, it's a fine, fine, incredible film.
Yep.
All right. So next week on Python.
Yeah. I was actually really surprised that this was a 1999 movie. I feel like there's just this like big swath of movies that I've seen because they were on like pretty heavy a rotation on like TNT or TBS, and this like felt like one of those movies, those sort of like late 80s, like early kind of 90s movies. So just like my like a memory of this is I saw it. Not continually, but saw like different segments of it, different times it aired on like a TNT.
Yeah, I would. It's funny you say that because, and Bart and I talked a little bit before we got on mic, but this film does feel like it's in some sort of a purgatory, like tonally and in terms of just all of it, it doesn't feel like it kind of fits anywhere. Like it is sort of soft. I mean, it is soft, but it's also rated R. Unnecessarily rated R, in my opinion.
The F word over and over again.
Yeah, there's a lot of F words, and there's, you know, there's talk of premature ejaculations, but like ultimately, it doesn't need to be rated R, which I would argue hurt its box office for sure. Like if this was PG-13, this movie at least breaks even. But it's rated R for no good reason. It's also too long. Like it's kind of meandering in a way that, to your point, kind of feels a little bit almost like an late 80s, early 90s throwback. Yeah, I'll say this. I was really excited to watch this movie.
I know you were.
Kenny and and Bart can attest, I'm a hockey fan. I grew up in Toronto. I love hockey. They don't make a lot of hockey movies, and I'm beginning to realize why. I don't know that it is the most
cinematic.
It's not the most cinematic sport. And this has been said many times by people that I talk to about hockey, which is that it doesn't play well on TV. Going to see a live hockey game is fucking great, but when it's filmed, the energy of it, something gets lost in that transition. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but it's not a sport that works as well filmed.
Bart, are you a hockey guy?
I'm not. I wanted to be. I feel like it was probably like the 90. It was either the 88 or like the 92. You know, Olympics. It was like, you know, I saw that and was just like, got to get in on this hockey thing. And so
you also
it was
had
like,
the Devils. You had the New Jersey Devils. They were fucking huge.
Yeah,
there's no such thing as a Devils fan.
Yeah, people just actually. Yeah, like I mean, like from like. From
no,
what
I'm not kidding.
It's just not a thing that people like know about.
Oh, okay.
And so they're, it's like
they are Rangers,
like, a lot of Islander fans and Ranger fans, and like didn't the Devils like ruin hockey? Like,
they slowed it down. So they won by grinding the gears of the sport.
Right, yeah,
they won like three cups that way.
Right, yeah, which does kind of make me weirdly proud that they just like like this like sport of sort of like. Speed and grace and power, they kind of just like it kind of reduced it to this stalemate of like war of attrition.
Yeah, they literally like their team would never score like more than two goals and they would win games that way.
And they're the best goalie of all time, right?
Yes. Yeah. Martin Brodeur.
So then I was like, oh, I want to do that. But it was like the nearest rink was like an hour away. And hockey's actually like reasonably expensive to get started in if you're starting from scratch, because there's like all this, or at least there it was, because you have to buy all this equipment and stuff. So I was never
in America. It is, I think, in Canada you're just given skates and sticks and whatever. When
I think
born,
you
right?
have to, yeah.
You're bequeathed them by the government.
That is not true. As someone who cannot skate, I just can say that is not an accurate portrayal of Canada. But I will say that the sport of hockey is a big deal, obviously. Mm-hmm. People watch it religiously. I will say that, and I mentioned this to both of you before we got on here, but I watched Miracle for the first time yesterday, which I had never seen before, the 2004 Kurt Russell. Oh my God, what's the director's name? The guy? Anyway, you know, he just did the Way Back as well. Like he's a good director of sports.
Yeah, Gavin O'Connor.
You know what I'm talking.
Is that his name?
That's it. Yeah, Gavin O'Connor. Yeah, and watching Miracle, which I never watched before, because it felt sacrilegious to root for Team USA, even in the form of being a viewer of the film. I just had never watched it before. And then I watched it, and it's a better movie than this movie, I think. It's very well made. He actually really directs the hockey well. I wouldn't say that this is poorly directed on a hockey level, but it's not visceral. It's more like quaint. And that's the nature of this type of hockey.
I mean, I don't want to compare too much to Miracle. They're like such different movies, but
yeah.
I mean, it's hard to fuck up Miracle, right? It's like, and I think it's better than it could be. I think the moment with Kurt Russell and the alone in the tunnel after they win is one of the best sports moments there is.
Yes.
So I think like Miracle is a fine movie. I'd be remiss to not mention Mighty Ducks, all of which I saw in the theaters twice. I'll see all three of them. I don't necessarily agree that hockey makes for bad cinematic fodder.
Okay.
I think this movie assumes some things about it, about the population at large and hockey, that aren't true. Like I don't think the population at large, at least in America, understands hockey. And I don't think the population...
When you say understands, do you mean the...
The rules of hockey the fandom of hockey and certain places' obsession with hockey. The whole thing doesn't read as, to me, as quaint or quirky or cute, it reads as bizarre that the three town elders of the three town elders of Mystery Alaska have a meeting every week to determine which eight residents of Mystery Alaska get to play in a game that the entire town attends. Or I guess it's 10 members, right? They play 4-on-4 with goalies. So 10 members that the entire...
Why is that bizarre? How is that any more bizarre than a college football or a small town football team?
Because the college football team is not playing against other people from the same college, for one. So it's not a scrimmage.
Well, and I mean, like,
this is just sport for sport. You're not rooting.
Well, and it's also just a thing that we don't have any context for. So it's like, if you say this is like a college football team and we're going to do a movie about a college
football team. That's my point.
It's like, you know, like a good percentage of the audience is going to understand a ton of context there. And so here you're saying,
right,
like, okay, this is about a hockey team, which a lot of people probably don't have a ton of context for. But then also, it's not like the hockey teams you know. It's this weird small town kind of setup. And so there's just a lot of stuff that they have to like load the audience with.
But I don't want this point to be lost. This isn't a hockey team. This is a pickup game. These are 10 people who come together that are chosen by three elder members of the town to play in a game against each other. The stakes are zero. The stakes are simply, can you play in this game or not? Once you're in the game, it's can you do well, I guess. I mean, can you have fun? Can you rouse the crowd? College football is clear. You're an Alabama fan. You want to beat Auburn. Okay, you want to beat Mississippi.
The college football analogy, I understand, is doesn't work. But I don't know that I necessarily feel it being as strange as you guys did, which is, I mean, listen, that's what it is. But
you're a Canadian who grew up with hockey.
Well, no, I was going to say that the small townness of this, the sort of snow globe kind of picket fencey David E. Kelly cute quirky small town component, is why it didn't seem that odd to me. Like that's the buy-in, right? Like he's created this sandbox and he said, like, here is this group of kind of quirky, sweet-natured people, and they play hockey. Like, okay, that to me didn't seem that strange.
So agreed. So I agree. I understand what you're saying. The setup is not unbelievable. The setup is right. That's what. Well, right.
Yeah,
kind of. I mean,
kind of. Not this, but this.
We'll get into it in a second. Right. The setup is not unbelievable. What's then the big jump to me is what is essentially a exhibition game played amongst friends for the entertainment of people living in this town is turned into something wildly competitive.
Yes.
Which is Mystery Alaska, this remote town hours outside of Fairbanks against the world that they truly and clearly don't give a shit about. Like, very clearly don't care about. And I'm forced to believe, I don't know exactly, like, where the goals are, where the motivation is, where the drive is, who's driving this story, why this is happening, why these people 100%. Care. And I actually think, like, this is, and again, this is not like, I'm not rewriting the movie, this is what it is, but something that kind of reminds me of this a little bit is in American Samoa, There's a big football culture, right? And a lot of Samoans wind up in the NFL. I mean, famous people, Junior Seau, and I think Sean Merriman is Samoan. And don't quote me on that, but a lot like Tro Palomalu, and a lot of famous Samoans wind up in the NFL. And I do think that this seems more like a ethnic outsider story, where people have created their own enclave away from the mainstream because they weren't allowed in, right? And I don't get the sense that these Alaskans weren't allowed in. I don't get the sense that they ever wanted to go in. So that's that kind of is where the disconnect is to me.
Well, I mean, like, and I guess I will also say, like, one thing that's kind of crystallized though for me is that as you were just laying out kind of the setup, it does sound interesting. It just didn't, like, this idea that they have a sort of like self-imposed outsider status and that like they're not interested in the outside world.
That's,
you know,
right.
They just like, yeah, like just do their thing for the purity of it. Like, that's not an uninteresting a setup. You know, it's like that is, could be cool. It just didn't seem like it really came together here because, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons. In part, I do think the David E. Kelly, you know, sort of like thing, the cutesy small town, it just doesn't seem like it's aged particularly well.
Well, yeah. Sean Merriman is not Samoan. Sorry about that.
Bart and I talked a little bit about this before you hopped on, Kenny, but I ultimately think that there's a lot of problems with this movie. I'm not sitting here saying this movie is great by any means. I was excited for this movie because I thought that I knew what this movie was. And then I watched the movie and was like, oh, it's trying to be 10,000 things.
What did you think the movie was?
I mean, I truly thought it was like, oh, it's a movie about, you know, a small town team of a small town hockey team. And they play the big, bad fucking New York Rangers or whatever. And it's an underdog story. And, you know, and ultimately on some level it is that, but it's so scattershot with an ensemble that's unnecessary, and all these different things going on. It's a fucking courtroom drama at some points, and it's a this, like it's all over the fucking place that you're just like, oh, I was expecting a clean 90-minute movie about a group of guys that played hockey, and you know, it's a ragtag group of guys playing the New York Rangers at the end, and I was excited for that. And that movie could have been a good movie, but this movie is, and you know, I said this to you earlier, Bart, but like David E. Kelly's sort of picket fencey TV brain infected this thing. So he felt like he had to, like, this thing feels like a more like a pilot than it does. Like, it feels like a fucking giant pilot for a TV series than it does a movie. Like, it doesn't really,
I agree with that,
conclude itself particularly well. And you've got all these strands of stuff that it unfortunately never coalesced. Like, I don't want to keep comparing it to Miracle, but the thing about Miracle that works so well is it's laser focused on a fucking thing. Like, it's clean. It knows what it is, right? Like, it's this team and they want to beat the Russians, and then they beat the Russians, and you've got your Kurt Russell character that is clearly your protagonist. I'm not even convinced that Russell Crowe's the protagonist of this movie. Maybe he is. I sort of think he is, but like, is he? I don't know.
I don't know if it's best to discuss this from here, but
go for it.
I'm not sure that this is a hockey movie. Like it, like, well, yeah, or yeah, even just a sports movie, because it's like, and you know, because the reason that sports movies I think can work is because like everything becomes about one thing and is told through the lens of that sport. And so you also have the sort of rhythms and, you know, sort of just like the visual dynamicism of a sport. And
right,
so there's not a ton of hockey played in this until the end. Right.
That's
and
true.
We're not telling the story of the hockey team. There are more characters off the ice getting a ton of screen time.
Correct.
And I think that's one of the reasons that just structurally the movie feels so odd is it is actually an interesting structural puzzle in that what it seems like they tried to do was to bring a variety of storylines to a sort of not even a traditional midpoint as much as a sort of stalemate in the story. Like, you know, there was the little a marriage section in the middle where it's like, mm-hmm, oh, you know, some hints of infidelity or actual infidelity, and they talk about it, and both of the, you know, like they sort of both state their sides and then kind of just go, well.
It's interesting that you say that, Bert, because first of all, I totally agree with you that this movie doesn't feel particularly interested in hockey. It seems interested in, I guess, how hockey makes you feel, or hockey as a vehicle for other emotions as opposed to the sport itself, which is interesting because, like, and I didn't know this until I was doing research on this, but like David E. Kelly is the son of an NHL executive and the captain of his hockey team at Princeton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that the producers of this film were owners of the Pittsburgh Penguins and previously owned the Hartford Whalers. Like, there were fundamental hockey people involved in this movie, mm-hmm. and yet you kind of wouldn't know it.
So I want to piggyback on what Bart was saying. I mean, this is all kind of really interesting to me. And another little thing about the producers, the first hockey film they did was Sudden Death, the Jean-Claude Van Damme yeah. movie, which is fucking fantastic.
It is. It is great.
It might be his best work.
Doesn't he fight a mascot?
He does, and then he becomes the mascot. There is a really, really good. I saw three movies the day I saw Sudden Death. Sudden Death, Grumpy or Grumpier Old Men, and Nixon.
Jesus.
Wait, did you say the same day?
Same day, yeah.
What was do you remember what was going on in your life?
Yeah, kind of.
These three lined up.
Well, first of all, that's me. Second of all, I'm pretty sure that was 95, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I know Nixon was 95. Yeah. What year was Grumpy Old Men?
I think that's 95. All in the theater? Because that sounds like a day just with like a lot of candy around and like Blockbuster.
Right. It was all in the theater. It was Grumpier Old Men. So okay. I don't quite remember. I know that the Sudden Death was really early, and then Grumpier Old Men, and we saw them back to back. And then for some reason, my parents
Nixon was the chaser.
Yeah,
Nixon was the night film because I left it went back and as a 13-year-old sat through Nixon for 3 hours after all of that. I think
Nixon's a great movie though.
I think they're all fine films. But Mystery Alaska was 4 years later. And the point I wanted to make about what you're saying, Bart, is it's not a sports movie. There's a thing that's very weird about this movie. Is you have the all right, so Hank Azaria plays this former resident of Mystery, moved to the lower 48, is now a journalist of some sort, wrote an article for Sports Illustrated, yeah, that was all right, and is now and the article basically says the players in Mystery Alaska is quite a little town. They have this great little hockey game every week. And these players are basically as good as NHL players. That's it. We are meant to believe that.
I'll tell you
why we're meant to believe that. Because at some point, like, all right, so Russell Crowe, the conversation the whole time is, well, you know, if we play by NHL rules, we're going to get smoked. But if we play by our rules, which are also legitimate because it's pond hockey, we'd smoke them, which is some small town stupid bullshit that I hate. Now, furthermore, this is very extemporaneous.
Great. Extemporaneous but delicate.
So furthermore, we play by the Rangers rules, we play by the NHL rules, we play 5-on-5 with goalies with boards, which you don't play in pond hockey. The team never tries to get better. There is no training. There's no arc of, well, we're not that good at this style. Maybe we should try to get better. The arc is like we're playing by their rules and let's just give it our best shot doing what we do.
Yeah. And in fact, the only sort of training montage there is focuses almost exclusively on the one thing we're told over and over again they're great at, which is skating.
Skating.
So it's just them doing skating drills where it's like, this is the one thing that you guys are supposed to be great at. you don't need to work on this. Well, there was the scene with the potatoes.
Yes, yes.
When Russell Crowe was breaking down 5-on-5, whereas like an offenseman has to drop back. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess that was the only time.
I mean, there's also they were teaching the rules. I mean, like but it's true.
There's also the leadership component too. The whole coaching fiasco that they go through. That's also that I can't imagine is good for a team. But anyway,
we're not told the entire movie that Burt Reynolds had anything to do with his team, and then we're told with about 30 minutes left that like the secret to this is Burt Reynolds being coach.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I actually had like a fun ride through this movie because, I guess my expectations was I thought it was going to be more of like the Rocky thing that it was like,
yeah,
this seems not very good, but for some like publicity reason, they have to kind of like pull it together and give the Rangers like a good game. And I guess having only done this podcast once before, there was this period in the beginning where it's just like, oh, I got to really pay attention and like note little things because I might not have anything to talk about, you know? And so it was like in the beginning, it was just like the notes were like, you know, oh, it's funny that they thought that this helicopter looked Russian. It's like, oh, like that's just like a weird moment in like a movie. But then as the movie begins to unfold, it's just like, oh, I actually don't need to take small notes because the big giant headlines of this movie are so crazy. It's like at some point I was just like, this game needs its own a thematic drinking game. Like every time a new theme is sort of introduced, because there is just a million just things like thrown in there where it's just like about the road less traveled, fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, small town versus large town, ambition. It's just like,
and corporate America as well, like corporate takeovers.
Right. It is just a thematic chaos in this movie where it's just a thing is introduced and then two scenes later it's resolved and you never hear from it again. Like it does move like a warp speed television show.
I just wanted to jump in here real quick because I think it's interesting just to talk for a second about David E. Kelley as a feature writer, because we did mm-hmm. Lake Placid a few weeks ago, Kenny, and it does feel like David E. Kelley. I would argue Lake Placid's a stronger script than this script for sure, because it's a little bit sort of like it's a little cleaner, I guess, and it's sort of like it's a monster movie and whatever. But, like, I don't really think he does a great job at writing either feature, really. Like, structurally, he likes to be inside a television show where, you know, he can kind of ping-pong around a bunch of characters and tell a bunch of different themes with a bunch of, and then move on to the next episode.
I obviously thought a lot about the fact that David E. Kelley wrote 4 movies in his life and 2 of them happened to come out, or got 4 that were produced and 2 of them happened to come out in 99, which is crazy. The 2 that came out are Mystery Last and Lake Placid, which is crazy. These movies have nothing to do with each other except they're both on lakes. primarily lake-based movies.
Right, yeah.
But
you got to go where the muse leads.
As you know, I think Lake Placid is an exceptional movie. I think it's an exceptional movie, and
it's a good movie.
And I'm trying to think of why that worked and this didn't from a psychoanalytical point of view, which is fun part, right?
So, and also, he loved and played hockey. You would think he'd be better at this one.
That's my concern. Is what I'm getting at. So. And I don't mean that in like a derisive way, but what I say is like, all right, every time I write a feature, and this tells you a lot about me because I'm not the greatest writer. Every time I sit down to write a feature, I also sit down with some kind of guide, a new guide.
Sure, sure.
Every time, just to reach, because I'm normally writing television, but I try to write a feature every year, retrain my memory or retrain like my mind on how to write a feature. And my goal is always I'm going to stick to what it says in this book or wherever I'm going because this is how you do it. And then, frankly, the good ones, I stick to it, and the bad ones, I deviate because it's hard to deviate from normal structure. Like, obviously, sure, the movies we love so much do, but those are written by masters, and I am just, you know, a guy. So it feels to me like David E. Kelly with Lake Placid stuck to the structure. Now, he didn't stick to typical horror structure because he didn't do the whole Final Girl thing where you're killing, killing, killing. But there is like a gradual escalation of the fear and tension leading to a massive climax at the end. And when we had Delandra on, she went point by point of the way he stuck to monster movie or creature feature structure. This movie does not stick to sports movie structure in any way. What it feels like to me is David E. Kelly wanted to do a slice of life that he does so well in some of his shows, wrapped around a sports theme that doesn't necessarily fit that well. Now, I would, I may have done it a different way. Like, I may have focused on the town that happens to have this thing happening around it, and make it significantly less about, can we beat the Rangers? Will this embarrass our town? Will this like show that we are lesser than the lower 48 or whatever?
You would have written the script that was titled Mystery Alaska, which is about the fucking place as opposed to about the sport.
I think that's what I would have tried to do and make it more, you know, and it's a much harder, it's a much harder script to write, but make it more Altman-y and more, you know, like seed these stories from the first act, as opposed to seeding them in the middle of the second or even sometimes late in the second or early in the third, where they get resolved very fast, as Bart said, and would have, you know, there are some movies, sports movies. The thing with sports movies, if it's based on a true story, you could do the thing Miracle did, which is have the underdogs win. If it's not, you kind of can't. You kind of can't tell that story. It just seems so unbelievable. So, or ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So I would have, I think, just focused a lot less on the can the underdogs win instead of middling it like I think they did, to the point where it's this amorphous, it's not really a mess. It's just all kind of apropos of nothing.
Yeah.
And a movie that does something like this that I also don't really like, but more because of content, less because of structure, is it reminds me a lot of Beautiful Girls.
I thought that too.
You thought that too? That it has that same kind of like early 90s. And this is why I think Bart might have had that like 80s, 90s, you know, kind of sense memory. This early 90s, like, we're going to show you a place and a time and an outsider who's in this place, maybe lapsed from this place. And some things that happen and some good, some bad, we'll resolve ourselves as much as we can and we'll get out. And I don't know. I mean, I do think Beautiful Girls works pretty well from a structural storytelling point of view.
Yeah, I mean...
They're also all very snowy places too. But sorry, go ahead.
Just to point out, like, I think the other way to do this movie, the more traditional way, which would be less interesting than the way that you're suggesting, would be to do it through the team, is to give sort of each team member, you know, just like a little story, like a context besides, you know, the only one that's really done for is the sex addict Skank, and like seeing his like just...
There's a
absurd storyline, but like,
but I mean, like, I agree with that completely.
Yeah,
like, but that's.
I want this structure to work because, like, there is like something about the storytelling rhythm, and I'd be curious to hear you guys respond to this. That I don't want this movie to have failed because of the structure as much as because of just like the scenes and what people were saying and doing, as sort of not particularly artful. Because I will say, by the end of this movie, I feel like ultimately the climax for me was more emotional and borderline worked. Because although it wasn't necessarily a great journey, because of the amount of story that had been covered, I did feel like I had watched something large scale. Like the movie felt long actually in a good way, because it was just like, oh, like this has been an adventure because we got to know so many people. And the moment where, like, I guess it was also just like shot kind of well, like although there weren't a lot of bells and whistles, the sort of extended quiet of the moment after the final goal is not scored, I actually thought it was pretty effective.
You know, I actually, like, I completely agree with you. Like, I agree with everything you just said, right? I am harping on structure for some reason, but another reason feels a little like Beautiful Girls-y to me is because we have these mini stories that you alluded to, the one with Lolita Davidovich and Colm Meaney.
The mayor.
Where Colm Meaney is the mayor, and she's been cheating on him with Skank Ron Eldar. Mm-hmm. And we have the other one with Russell Crowe and Mary McCormick.
Yes.
And Hank Azaria, where Mary McCormick and Hank Azaria used to be a couple before he moved. And it seems like they're flirting again. Russell Crowe is skeptical of what's going on there. Both of these stories don't so much fail because of incompetence. They fail because of familiarity. These are stories we have seen told so many times in the exact same way on shows like 30-something and on shows like
Picket Fences,
and on on so many television shows and so many movies of the 80s and 90s that it doesn't feel – it feels like there's no urgency to go to these stories.
I want to agree and piggyback on it a little bit and just say that I actually – both the storylines that you just pointed out I think are work relatively well, but – the thing that I was really hit with watching this film, kind of shocked by, was the direction being as weak as it was. Because I think Jay Roach is a good director. Like, I don't know if he's a great director, but I think he's a good director. And he's shown that he can do stuff like this, either through the HBO stuff that he's done or even through the Meet the Fockers movies. Like, he is a competent director who can get solid performances out of people. And this movie was shockingly stilted at times, where lines just landed with thuds and performances from actors who I know are good actors just didn't resonate. And two scenes in particular that speak to what you're talking about, Kenny, which is the scene in the ice fishing hut with Lolita and Colm, which actually was a nice scene and actually I thought worked quite well. And then the big fight between Mary McCormick and Russell Crowe, which I don't think works as well because there's just the energy's not there. There's a little bit of feeling, to your point, is very rote, Kenny. It feels like TV drama rather than movie drama, which is distinctly different. Like, it's just on television, it's allowed to feel not just smaller, but it's allowed to feel like less dynamic in a weird way. Whereas this just felt like, it felt a little flat, and that was the thing that hit me. Like, how flatly directed this movie was surprised me.
In movies, you have one shot. This is your story. In television, it's one part of hopefully like a 200-part story, and it's not. That's not an argument to make it worse or less interesting. Yeah. It's just as an audience member, your expectation isn't as high.
Yep.
Well, and you're so much more connected to the characters in a television show because you've just literally spent so much more time.
The investment.
Like to see like a couple dissolving on like a television show, you probably spent hours in the formation of that couple. And so you're so deeply connected to it as where in a movie, you know, you just meant them. We've probably only had them together on screen for 5 or 6 minutes at that point.
For sure,
the stakes just feel very low.
What did you guys think of Russell Crowe's makeup mechanism? Did you guys how he made up with
his hair was great?
How he made up with
Crowe. Oh, wow!
I thought Russell Crowe looked fantastic. I thought he looked
great, flowing hair.
He looked as handsome as I've ever seen him in a movie.
Yeah,
I agree. 100%.
I thought he gave a pretty good performance. He was there, and he was like, you know, he was present and like it was not a phoned in performance.
Yeah, and I would say I agree with you, Barb, but there's it's interesting because I was watching this film. We did The Insider about a month or so ago. And apparently Michael Mann went to Canada or talked with it. Either way, they figured out how they were going to do The Insider while he was shooting this film. Two drastically dissimilar performances in a lot of ways. But there is a quietness to this performance mm-hmm. that is, and a nuance to it. Like one of my favorite parts in it is where she says, you know, players say that coaching is, they often love coaching more yeah. than playing. Yeah. And why would they say that? He's like, because they can't fucking play. Like there's, you know what I mean? Like it's a great line and he delivers it with the pathos and the sadness that's yeah. necessary for a guy who really is at a crossroads.
Yeah.
I agree. I think Russell
yeah, I mean, he delivers, I wrote it down because it was so great. You know, with a straight face trying to find like the nuance of the character moment, he starts off that eulogy with my boy Mike asked Bailey how he got so fat. And it's like he wasn't just rip it off. He was just like, no, like yeah. this is yeah. This is, pretty funny. This is a moment for this character, and he gave it its due.
No shade on Alaskans.
Uh-oh.
There's a lot of talk about people's weight in this movie. Like, Rod Eldard's whole storyline is about how he called a woman he was having sex with fat over and over again?
Yeah, that's not yeah. great. It's not great.
Well, yeah. whatever.
It's, I mean, I agree with him. I agree with you, Bart, that like he finds ways to deliver lines in this film that give it more gravity yeah. and more depth than you would expect. So I will agree that like you've turned me around on Russell's performance specifically. And I think part of the problem is that it's not really a leading man performance, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like for this movie, it kind of needed something slightly larger than life, if that makes any sense. Like the movie is on his shoulders, and yet at the same time, it's a quiet performance, which adds to the sort of weird imbalance. Like, I don't know if that makes any sense, but it just
feels
like...
Yeah, no, for sure.
Like,
yeah, and yeah, like, and like, I think that shows up. It's like a metaphor for the whole movie is that he is kind of the leading man and the first character, but at the right. climactic moment, the goal, it's like he's in this awkward hug
yeah.
with
yeah.
a ranger, and it's like this other guy that's like, we don't really know, that's going to take the final one. Shot.
Right.
And it's just like, oh, like this is kind of exactly what you're talking about. It's like, is he the lead or is he the guy that's just over here?
Well, and he gets the big speech. He gets the big like locker room speech where he rises to the occasion and shows like that Russell Crowe stardom kind of
right,
moment.
Which was a great yeah. moment. Like the most like fully formed arc is really the judge. Like just the look he gives where it's like, you know, just clear that he was trying to set him off. Like it was just like, well done. Mm-hmm. Could we go back to the makeup mechanism that you were talking about? Because I would be really curious to hear.
Oh, yeah. I have one more point to make about this.
Okay, sorry.
I do want to go back to it because it reminds me. It's so funny. We just did Cradle of Rock, right? I don't know yeah. the order. I can't remember the order. They're similar. They're very similar movies in that
they are.
In that both of these movies lose what's interesting about it for side stories that are totally irrelevant, two of which take place in courtrooms, that don't move the thing forward. And what we sacrifice through that yep. is character development for the people who are going to play a big role in the climax.
Yep.
So to your point, Bart, the guy who, took the final shot. His last name is Banks. I can't remember his first name. As you know, the best player in Mighty Ducks is also Adam Banks. 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 As everyone knows. copycat. As everyone knows, the best player is Banks. We know nothing about this guy except he shot Michael McKean, which we also yeah. don't really know much about, which also was a very weird moment, which like, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of kind of unpack there that we will. We don't even know that much about Steve Wilkes, the 18-year-old who has premature ejaculation problems, except that he ejaculates prematurely.
And says it apropos of nothing other than that it's funny.
Well, I guess it was his concussion, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure that's a symptom.
No,
of a
I'm not defending it. I'm
just, who knows? just like Cradle with Rock, if you're doing a typical sports movie, and Bart, you made this point, I'm just reiterating. You focus on the players on the team. You give them all an arc, and that arc is realized within the context of the game at the end. This is 101 shit. This is what you would do if you took the sports movie book and said, how do you write a sports movie? Now, if you don't want to do that because hockey is so fucking important to you, and you're David E. Kelly who grew up playing hockey and your dad's an NHL exec and you want to tell a bigger, you know, wider, broader story, that's okay. And I commend him for trying, but I don't think this worked. And I think, like, I think you kind of lost the, you know, lost the trees for the forest.
I actually, it's funny you bring up Cradle of Rock because there are, they're both Disney films. They're both big ensembles. They're both kind of muddy. They both kind of come from a place of the writer's passion. And it just feels a little bit like they're just unwieldy in their own weird way. You know, I let me give the synopsis an hour into this podcast, but let me give the synopsis so that people can know what we're talking about. It's Mystery Alaska is a comical tale about the residents of a small, remote Alaskan town and their preoccupation with ice hockey. Excitement comes to town when, as part of a publicity stunt, the professional stars of the New York Rangers come to Alaska to face off against a local amateur team in a televised match. Small town intrigues and petty rivalries must be shelved as it, if the locals are to put up a respectable defense. It was written by David E. Kelly. It was directed by Jay Roach. It opened on October 1st in eighth place against Three Kings and Drive Me Crazy. It would go on to make $8.9 million on a $28 million budget. It's got 37% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 66% from audiences. I'm going to read a very brief clip here from Roger Ebert's 2.5 out of 4-star review where he says, Mystery Alaska is a sweet, pleasant, low-key, inoffensive, and unnecessary. It sticks up for underdogs, nice people in small towns, and doesn't like big corporations, adulterers, TV producers, and New Yorkers in general. It contains not only a big game with a thrilling finish, but also a courtroom scene, a funeral scene, an innocent teenage sex scene, a change of heart scene, and a lot of scenery. No one falls through the ice and almost no one drowns, but you can't hope for everything. I don't require that a sports movie end with the elk. What?
Does someone drown?
No, it says almost, it says, and almost drowns. No one falls through the ice and almost drowns, but we can't hope for everything. I don't require that a sports movie end with the outcome of a big game is decided, but neither do I recommend that it linger while the locals and visitors say goodbye to one another, tidy up every plot strand and demonstrate that their hearts are in the right place. I do think, however, I think this same cast in this same town could metamorphose into an entertaining sitcom. It almost feels like they metamorphosize out of one, which speaks to us, sort of speak, the pilot of it all. I mean, the cavalcade of things that happen in this movie really do feel like they're teeing up longer storylines that just don't come to fruition.
Do you think that part of the problem was the love of hockey by the sort of like creative team? Because I mean, I don't know how far 28 million would go on a movie in like a 99, but like, although the hockey is not great, it looks, you know, pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty
and
decent.
That's just such a resource hog production wise, like to get all of those people up to speed. Does it not leave time to sort of,
well, can I just, I just want to say one other thing, which speaks to what you're talking about, which is speaking of cost and speaking of sort of, perhaps vision or what have you, they built the entire town. They built the church. They built the cemetery. It was all built. The amount of money Disney spent on this thing was crazy. I mean, they wanted this town and all of this speaks to, and I hate to keep hammering this home, but it speaks to a pilot. Like it literally is the type of thing you do when you're investing in something that's going to in standing sets and that's going to last for 100 episodes. You don't do this for a movie about a bunch of like, it's very counterintuitive.
You used to. You know, that's you used to 20 years ago, people would, and you know, no one would bother with that now. To the point about, do I think it's because of a love of hockey? I think that's what I was alluding to earlier. There is a blank check equality to this. And
for sure.
The thing I love about the notion of blank checks is that an auteur gets to put forth his or her vision without any oversight. That's not necessarily a good thing. That's the whole point of the Blank Check podcast. And that's been my, you know, I've been pounding this drum for years and years about certain directors who no longer have any oversight and put together these like wildly unwieldy films or these wildly unfocused films or these yep. films that are about something very specific to them that aren't really for audiences or at least mass audiences. It just feels to me like there were a lot of things that the filmmakers, producers, directors, and writers thought were really important to get across when talking about hockey and talking about these people and this world that should have been caught at one of the several editing or notes giving stages. That's the sense I get. So
there is one small moment. It doesn't lead to a lot of conversation, but I feel like I have to bring up some of the courtroom stuff. And specifically,
please.
Specifically, which is, I mean, I guess it's just like, I feel like if I was listening to this podcast, this would be the moment that I would have to go and watch Mystery Alaska, because just after all of this talk, to be like, wait, there's a courtroom aspect of this? Like,
two
courtrooms. It's not small either. There are
two different courtrooms.
Right. And those two different courtrooms are adjudicating totally separate cases.
Yeah.
Like, there are two court storylines in this. But
one of them, by the way, and we'll get into both of them, but the union one actually kind of like made my brain melt a little bit.
Right. Well, and yeah, I mean, it was just, I mean, just like, yeah. But the thing that I just want to talk about, because
that one drives me nuts.
And the moment, like, I think this movie might contain the greatest single choice I've ever seen by an actor, which is the moment that Bailey is having the heart attack.
Correct. Yeah.
And the little look he gives
the judge
as he realizes he's having a heart attack and sort of like nods to his heart is just because he had been saying heart 2 seconds earlier as part of his big speech.
Oh,
and
no.
Then it's like, I certainly can't think of a better choice. I'm not saying it's the greatest performance. I'm just saying a single moment. I'm really skeptical that anyone has ever flown that close to the sun as an actor to be so perfectly in tune with the human condition at a single moment.
That's where Maury Chaykin lives, by the way.
It's our second Maury Chaykin performance. He was also an Entrapment. He's much better suited to this. He does a fine job in this film. I want to talk about the other courtroom scene, which I thought you were going to talk about that one, because that makes one of the single strangest storytelling decisions you'll ever see in a movie. To set it up, Michael McKean is an executive from basically fucking Walmart, right?
Yeah, I'll find the name of it, but yeah, go ahead.
He's coming to Mystery Alaska because, you know, Mystery Alaska now has 300 residents. Maybe they should open a Walmart. If they open a Walmart, it will, like, you know, this is, I don't have to break this story down. This is the story of America. If they open the Walmart, it'll threaten every other business.
The Price World?
Price World. That's right.
Sorry.
If you open the Walmart, it'll threaten every other business in America.
Correct.
The best player on the team is the bagger at the local market, who is also strapped, who for no real reason decides to threaten Michael McKean's character with a gun and then shoot not at him, but near him, so much so that the bullet ricochets off something and lodges itself into Michael McKean's foot.
Mm-hmm.
While Michael McKean is injured, shot in the foot, he lets out a stream of expletives about how horrible the town is. One might do that when shot for no reason in a town.
Not unreasonable.
I mean, you know, you say whatever you want. I mean, the other character gets a concussion and starts talking about his ejaculation habits. So this character, whose first name I can't remember, but last name is Banks, is then tried for, I guess, shooting a guy in the foot. At the trial, Michael Keane's statement to Russell Crowe, who's the town sheriff, I don't think we've said that yet, that the town is a bunch of, you know, backward hick fuckwads, whatever he says, is entered into evidence. That coupled with the fact that Mr. Banks is the best player on the team that they need for this game against the Rangers is enough for the jury to find him not guilty and decide to award him $40,000 in punitive damages, which they are not authorized to do because that's not what that court does. Right. It's a criminal trial. What I want to say is Burt Reynolds, a town judge, then goes on to chastise everybody in the court for prioritizing a hockey game over not just a man's foot.
Justice?
The rule of law. That's right.
Right.
Which isn't an uninteresting point for the movie to make.
Correct.
Except that it seems like the movie comes down on there are some things that are more important than the rule of law, justice, and a man's shattered foot. And that's town pride and hockey and the rights of a small town grocery bagger to show his stuff on national TV against the Rangers. That's the end of my argument.
I also just feel like, you know, the more we talk about this film and quite frankly, the batshit things that happen in it and the amount of them, it just makes me feel like maybe David E. Kelly, who is also concurrently writing 150 episodes of television same time, didn't give this film the necessary amount of time to really think all of these storylines through.
Do you guys ever cannibalize your own scripts? I.e. take a scene from an old script, put it in a new script, take an idea from an old script, put it in a new script. I think that might have happened here.
You think?
I think he might have taken a couple of discarded Law and Order scenes. I mean, L.A. Law scenes, and stuck them into this. Possible.
I mean, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels so. I mean, can we just talk for a second here about the Burt Reynolds character? Just Burt Reynolds in general.
Love Burt Reynolds.
I don't have anything against Burt Reynolds.
Love him.
I don't know that he's
old Burt Reynolds. I love his face.
Yeah. Is he good in this? Beard.
He's great in this. He's great in this. Yeah. Okay. I guess I'd have to review to see if he does it like a textbook good job as an actor. No, but he does.
I think he's great in this too.
He's perfect in this. And it's just really height, like late Burt Reynolds powers. Like, you know, sort of just like he's, I think, one of the few people that like really made like the transition from the coolest guy ever to a punchline, but like made that work for him. He's just perfect here.
He did a thing. I love Burt Reynolds for what you're saying. He was the coolest guy ever in the 70s. He became a punchline in part because he lost all his money and had to be on Evening Shade.
Yeah.
Right. Like he didn't really have an option here. He had to go make money, and that was kind of an embarrassing thing. But when he reemerged in Boogie Nights with that performance.
He's great in it, but he also hates that movie.
Well, whatever. When he reemerged, got nominated for an Oscar, probably should have won that Oscar. The middle section of his career where he wasn't cool, where he was a joke, where he's playing some, Colonel Sanders character in Striptease, went away. It was gone for me.
It's true.
And he just became super fucking cool again. He became the coolest fucking grandpa. And here's my feeling about him in this movie, Bart. Not only is he good, he's too good for this movie. He actually is. He blows everybody else off the screen. He's so fucking good. He looks so powerful. He sucks in the energy of everything he's in. Yeah. I think Paul Meany is the anti Burt Reynolds, and that like there's something about him that like he repels all the energy. Like I want to be so far away from Paul Meany when he's on screen. Particularly, I've never seen him play like a sympathetic character in my life, but. Burt Reynolds is like, there's just, my God, I just want to sit at its foot and learn.
I guess, let me rephrase because I think that part of the problem, and I'm agreeing with you, but I also think that part of it is that he stands out so much in this movie.
I think that's right.
That it actually creates an imbalance, right? Yeah. To your point. So, you know, when he, like the first time you see him, like when they're watching the game and he's seeing his daughter kissing the guy and it cuts to him and you're like, fuck, like there's a legitimate fucking movie star here. Like there's a person who outshines and is bigger than everybody. So much so that you're just like, it creates a lot of weird, just a weird energy. I can't really explain it outside of the fact that like, I like his storyline for the most part.
It's such a good point though.
But it creates these situations where like that dinner scene where you're just like Bert's like just fucking playing with live ammo and everyone is shooting with blanks. Like the guy who plays his son, Bertie, like they are not, when their scenes are together, I feel for Scott Grimes because it's like you're not in the same weight class, man. Like you can't play against Burt Reynolds.
But those scenes aren't better if Burt Reynolds is not in them, right? Like,
not necessarily,
I understand this thing you're saying intellectually is that like his sort of like star power sort of like creates, like helps you to notice the disparity between it and the other people he's in scenes with. And that can make it seem a little.
But it also feels like Burt doesn't need to be directed. Mm-hmm. Right, like Bert saying a line, even Bert at 60 or 70% is saying a line 150% better than its counterpart in the scene. So it makes Scott Grimes, who needs to be directed mm-hmm. and can't get to that place, half the scene feels stilted, the other half feels something.
Here's what I kind of think is going on for Burt Reynolds' entire career since we become aware of him. Casting Burt Reynolds was a choice, right? Sure. You're not filling a role. You are putting Burt Reynolds in a role, right? Casting Paul Meany is getting an actor. Casting Maury Chaykin's getting an actor. Casting Hank Azaria, even Russell Crowe. Almost at this point in his career, almost everybody in this movie is filling a role as best as they can. But there's something about casting Burt Reynolds where you've made a choice that there's going to be somebody in every scene that he's in who is going to fundamentally alter the way that scene comes across. I don't think the movie recognized what it was doing in that sense. I think that might be what I'm getting at. What Phil's getting at, what I'm getting at. I think that the scenes with Burt Reynolds, with the exception of when he's the judge, because he is supposed to command that respect and he is supposed to command that room. Yeah. But for the most part, he's just treated as another player in this world. When if I were in that world, I would be like, all right, we have this guy. This guy is everything. This guy is the guy you go to for answers. This guy is the guy you go to when Hank Azaria comes. This guy is the guy you have to negotiate with the Rangers. Like, this guy is the guy you're going to, like, step one, because he's Burt Reynolds and he is who you want representing any situation you're in. So I think that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, I mean, it's obviously a very different movie, but Paul Thomas Anderson very consciously knew what he was doing with Tom Cruise. Almost every other character in that movie is cast with a person who just is probably the best actor to play that role. But Frank T.J. Mackey, like, is a particular comment on a particular type of person. And he knew that Tom Cruise had to be utilized and weaponized in that sort of way
correct.
For that character to work. That wasn't necessarily the case with this.
But I don't think Bert is weaponized in this.
No, he's filling a role. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
He's filling
right,
a role.
Right.
But
I guess what I'm just trying to understand is, do you feel like this was just another missed opportunity, or do you think that the way he was used is actually a negative? Do you understand the distinction I'm trying to make?
It's a good question. Yeah, no, I hear you.
I
think in the end it is additive. Like in the end, I think it makes the movie better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also speaks to the bigger symptom we've been talking about in terms of its sort of instability and, mm-hmm. and this kind of like...
That's how I feel too.
Kitchen sinkiness of it, where you're just like, well, that worked and that worked, but like it's creating all these weird moments. I certainly wouldn't like... I think what you're asking to a certain degree, Bart, is would I have preferred them cast a quote-unquote lesser actor to create more of a flat line? I mean, this movie is all flat lines, so I'm not going to say yes to that. You know,
right.
I gotta say, the more we talk about this movie, the more fascinating I find this movie, even in its failure to a certain degree. I do have to say that there's a lot going on in it that I can't really wrap my head around. There's also just like an inherent laziness to it as well.
I do think it's a better movie. It's hard to say, right? Like it's hard to say, you know, to discuss the counter because,
yeah,
I think Burt Reynolds' scenes are the best, and I think he is the best, most interesting performance in the movie. I also think it speaks to something that you said a general laziness. It's almost like a neglect, like.
Yes,
when
that's a better word for it.
When movies cast movie stars in roles that aren't your protagonist, and they don't think about how that movie star persona plays into this, whether you're using it or whether you're, you know, going against type, it always does stick out and feel wrong and weird. And I think that's the. Again, it's not really a value judgment thing. It's a square peg round hole thing. And I think that might be what I'm feeling. Cause in the end of the day, like I think kicked ass, but I also think like the movie wasn't really built for that kind of performance.
Well, it feels like a missed opportunity. Like this movie as a whole just feels like a missed opportunity. But so go ahead.
What were you going to say?
Oh yeah. Well, no, I was going to say that. Yeah, I mean it. I mean, this movie feels to me like a lot of missed opportunities. There's a lot of movies in here. Like, it almost feels like you took, and I guess this is maybe like what happened, but it was like you took a really, really great screenwriter just before you shot each scene, said, okay, like you have an hour to like raise the stakes in this scene. And then like, that's what they shot because there were so many things in this that were sort of clearly to address a sort of concern about a particular scene without like maybe like tracking through all the story ramifications or making sure that the groundwork had been laid to that scene. Like I'm thinking kind of specifically of one of the times the Rangers were going to pull out, right? It's like the news is being delivered to like the town father and he's like, you know, but we've spent all this money and like we're all sort of like a leveraged into this thing. And it's just like, we have not been telling the story about the resources of this town being committed to this thing. And it's like, it just seems like an idea that is introduced because in this scene, in this moment, we need more tension. Like it's the point where there should be higher stakes. And it kind of felt like that was happening throughout with character stuff where it was just like, wait, what are they upset about? Like, have we been talking about this? Like, why is he doing this? Like, there was just a lot of that throughout the entire movie. So it's just like a lot of like a lack of cohesion. But I do just want to say, again, it really shows the power of an ending because I thought the ending worked. I thought, although they didn't stick the landing, the landing was like stuck adjacent. and it left me thinking, all right, I enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my biggest thing ultimately would have just been to cut about 15 minutes out of it. Like, I really think that the pacing ultimately hurt it, maybe more than anything. I just found myself just being like, I don't need this. I think the thing that, and we need to discuss this because I'm not entirely sure I understood it to begin with, but the whole storyline with the, which you alluded to, which is the Rangers pull out. So the union, the players organization sues the NHL. Is that what happens?
I think it's the opposite. I think it's, okay. I think it's okay. They utilize their union to say that the collective bargaining agreement does not allow for this. When I think it's stated very clearly early on that it does allow for this, that does allow for the NHL to schedule exhibition games at their whim. I think the Rangers challenge that in court, or the union challenges it in court.
Okay.
But the whole thing makes no sense. Like, frankly, the boys of Mystery Alaska or the people of Mystery Alaska should have no say in this in a courtroom. And it, and any appeal to sentimentality. I mean, I'm not saying that has no place in a courtroom, but a third party appeal to sentimentality in this courtroom does not really have any place.
Well, I mean, Kenny, yeah. I wish you were the lawyer. I wish you had said, someone had said those words in the courtroom.
I think that there's a story to be told, like a sort of like a behind the music story of the legal consultant for this movie, because there was some sort of like body swap or like deep cover operation where it's like, this person clearly knew nothing about the law.
It's David E. Kelly, man.
But was being forced to pose as a legal consultant and was just like, oh, well, there's this precedent about a guy having a big heart and, them overturning like a murder conviction. So like, you can probably use that. Like,
these stories are not designed to withstand any kind of stress test. Right. that's the thing. I think you can get away with that in TV a little easier. But no, they cannot. It is not,
but like that's the fat on this movie that I think could have been trimmed, that could have just streamlined it a bit. Because for me, I agree with you, Bart. Like, this is an innocuous movie. I certainly didn't hate it. Like, there's a lot of stuff to really like in it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff in it. It's just, if it got streamlined a little bit, my mind would wander when I'm off on some fucking in some courtroom about some that I clearly didn't really understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And you're just like, but what the fuck does this have to do with anything? Like, just get me back to the story with the fucking hockey players.
Right. It is like a strange ad to sort of like all of a sudden like want to like explore off camera the collective bargaining ramifications of
they're going to fucking play the game. Like, know the Rangers are going to show
up. That, so again, though, like, is just like they clearly came to points and were like, oh, like something has to happen. Okay, yeah. Just have the players pull out. And it's like, and so it's just like, okay, like.
And to your point, but like I said, you know they're going to play the game. Like, I don't think that's particularly fair. You know, that's storytelling, right? That's a second act complication. Yes, you know that John Wick is not going to die, but it does matter what happens over the course of the movie to him. What bothers me about this is I haven't been convinced that this game is important to the town. This game was foisted upon them, right? This game wasn't even their idea.
Yeah.
It was the NHL and Hank Azaria's idea for money. Like, I never got the sense that anybody other than Maury Chaykin really cared about showing the world what they had. Like, even the fact, like, and I want to say one thing real fast. I agree with you, Bart. Like, the end, it did kind of come together, and I was feeling it. I gave it a much better grade than I expected because of that. But this, very simply, like, the fact that these guys were being showcased on national television and they were written about in Sports Illustrated as on par with NHL players in a lot of ways.
Yep.
And it led to two of them getting minor league hockey contracts. That should have been a big driver of this movie. You could have had Banks and Wilkes, the two guys who wound up getting contracts, and a third guy. who could have said, this is our chance to get out of here, if it was a place to get out of, to make a lot of money, to bring back, you know, glory to this community, to do anything. But it never seemed like the opportunity really mattered to the town on a financial level, on an emotional level, on anything that I could really sink my teeth into. So that third act complication, specifically the Rangers are pulling out and this game might not happen,
has no stakes to it. Yeah,
not really. I mean, it has stakes because I know that this movie has to end with a game.
Yeah,
but like it doesn't really affect it that way. What seems like the stakes should have been local, it's not cold enough. The pond fucking isn't freezing over. Yeah. Now what do we do?
Yeah, and I mean it is a shame because again, it's like, you know, every time you sort of summarize the like a macro sort of like plot and themes of the movie, like it sounds so interesting. Like just the idea that it's like the small town, they do it different. And it's like, do they even want to leave? Is that even a good, like the idea of this, like sort of for the love of the game, they play this more like beautiful, graceful style. You know, how does that stack up against the sort of like highly regimented, violent, you know, but like hugely successful other style? Like that is a great place to start for a sports movie. And because it's not about sports, it's about everything, right? Right. It's a huge, it's like a huge question of like values and ambition for ambition's sake. Like, are these good ideas? And it just actually doesn't do that.
This is going to sound crazy, but almost more than any movie we've done, this could have been amazing. Like,
yes,
it could have.
This is my point. I was excited for this movie.
It really could have. It could have been an amazing movie. You just hit it on the head, Bart. And actually, like, I mean, I know no one has any love for Mystery Alaska, but like, there's a world where Disney Plus makes this a television show.
For sure.
And it really fucking flies. Now they're doing Mighty Ducks like they wouldn't do it, but you put it on Hulu and you make it R, and I had a
pitch with one of the Sleepy Hollow writers. We were trying to put together a Mystery Alaska thing.
Yeah.
Again, not to beat a dead horse, but this is a lot more setup than it is payoff. And it does create a world that I find quite endearing in a Northern Exposure kind of way. Those first shots of the town, those first shots, honestly, those chopper shots of him skating on that open ice and seeing the town that they built, they did a beautiful job. Like, it feels lived in. It feels inviting. You want to root for these people. You want to love these people. And unfortunately, the movie just never fully gets there because it thinks it's already there. Like, it almost feels as though it's a foregone conclusion. There's a lot of that kind of vibe to it, and it just is not there.
And I'm not saying it has to do this, but it doesn't even answer the question. It doesn't even acknowledge the question, which is the NHL the goal? Is the NHL something they want? Is the NHL, you know, the bad guy or the good guy? And if I understood their relationship with, again, the lower 48, and the NHL and kind of mainstream hockey, and not just, you know, excuse me, Canada as well, mainstream hockey, then I think I might get this movie a little better. Even if it was, like you said, we don't need anything to do with it. Stay out of our town. And we're going to continue to play our 5-on-5. And it's as important and as valid to us. Because then if there was just one person, like, it's such a simple story. If there was one person who had a real big fucking need and incredible talent and was like, you guys have to play this game for Steve. Like, forget you guys. Like, Steve could be the next Wayne Gretzky, and he's stuck in this town in your backward ways.
Yeah.
And if he has, this is his one opportunity to actually get on a major stage and impress people. Like, that seems clear to me. That seems easy to me.
There's two things that I want to say about that, because I think they're both – I absolutely agree with you. The first is the Charlie character, the Hank Azaria character. If we had, if there had been some motivation towards why he wanted to put this on the map, if we got the sense that he was trying to sort of help this town that he came from, you know what I mean? Something – or even the opposite. You know what I mean? He hates the town. Right. Whatever the fuck it is. But like he feels
here,
kind of wobbly too, right? Where you're just like, what's happening on that front? And then on the other side, I just wanted to, on the Charlie front, there's that scene, the town hall scene, right, where they're trying to figure out whether or not they actually want to do this game or not and whether or not it's a good idea for the town. That scene should have felt like fucking Stars Hollow or Picket Fences to me. I should have felt everybody in that town is a character and a person that I'm invested in. But instead, it felt kind of lackluster. I didn't even really feel them all rally around the idea. Like, these are kind of one-on-one, 101 things that you need for the small townness to work. And when that's not working, that really hurts the movie.
I think actually what's I think that's all right. But I think the thing that's extra frustrating is that the movie like agrees with you. It just doesn't because it actually says why Hank Azaria is that he's saying his name?
Yeah.
You know, he has the scene where he's drunk on the Zamboni and like he explains his motivation, but you're right to miss it because it's like, that's not how you do this. Like, that's not how you unpack a sort of like complex sort of like internal story where it's like, he's like, I didn't leave here. I was like rejected. He wanted to go out and become kind of successful to return to this town to get the respect to kind of say fuck you to them.
I can't wait. I can't wait till we pitch this show though, because like,
but, and that's
I'm
all
not
good.
Kidding. Like this yeah. is they're yeah. Like it's
just it's, too fast. You can't do it like in like half a scene.
I know. And I feel like we're, and this is exactly what I was getting at in terms of the note giving process breaking down, the editing process breaking down, people being allowed to just put forth essentially first draft ideas without much oversight, because we've only been talking about this for an hour and a half. And yep. I see the movie like it's
yep.
If Hank Azaria, to your point, Bart, had a grander plan, and if the grander plan was my half brother, Steve, is incredible, but he's being held back by these very well-meaning people who are stuck in their ways and won't let him leave, and he has no concept that he's not allowed to leave yet. He is in Plato's fucking cave, right? He thinks he thinks this is the whole world. He thinks starring in the Saturday game is equivalent, or not even equivalent, either better than being Wayne Gretzky, or doesn't even understand what Wayne Gretzky is. But Hank Azaria has traveled to the real world and says, you can be Wayne Gretzky, and I'm going to figure out a way to do it. And if that was a third act reveal, if he turns at the end and says,
I agree,
did this all for you, like at the end of the day, and then, you know, the whole like, I did it for you, but then as viewers, we see, but it also helped this guy and her and him and the town as a whole, and everything's better because of it. Well, that would have been awesome.
Yeah. And, yeah, and like what could be so exciting about this reboot is that you can create all these tensions and you can actually have everyone be right. Because like I think the counterpoint to your Wayne Gretzky character is the sort of like eccentric genius hockey player who, you know, has been in this town forever, will be in this town forever. And like, because this is the way he likes to play. Like, he thinks that this is right. He thinks this is, like, spiritually fulfilling. And at first, he's going to refuse to be in the game with the Rangers because he's like, this is not what we do. Like, we don't prove ourselves. We're about the purity of this thing. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to get him to, you know, actually be a part of the game out of his loyalty to his friends. And then the Rangers are going to be like, here's this giant contract, you and a Wayne Gretzky guy. And our eccentric genius is going to go, no, like that's not what it's about for me.
Yeah.
You know, and then like the end of the movie is we have like a Wayne Gretzky getting announced in the starting lineup, and we have our other guys just a Saturday, and he's just out playing exactly where he's always wanted to be. And it's like everybody gets to be right. small towns are
the
right.
next generation yeah. and yeah, yeah, all yeah. that stuff. And this is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. So I just want to talk about things that actually happened in the movie we watched. What I want to talk about real quick is the Marla and Stevie storyline, which is... I thought it was pretty genuine, even if I didn't think that either of the actors were all that great. I thought that the scenes were nice with them. Again, this is a storyline that could have been completely pulled from the movie in terms of just in an effort to streamline, in an effort to clean things up. But I did think that the scene where Marla tries to have sex with him and the whole premature ejaculation thing was a nice scene. I thought that it was genuine. I thought that they played it well. I thought that it gave them a sort of a genuine believability to their relationship that I was surprised at. But then at the end, when she's like, but we didn't even get to have sex. She's like, don't worry, I'll be back in a couple months. I was like, he will not be a virgin when he comes back from wherever the fuck he's going. Yeah. But I did think that like, It was sweet in a way that I was kind of surprised at to a certain degree. I don't know how you guys felt about it.
I think, it feels like it comes pretty soon after that introduction
yeah.
of the character Skank. In the men's locker room telling yeah. story. And so like, I think that I was like tensed up. Like, so it's like as another scene, you know, just like a sex scene, I was just like, oh, like what's going to happen here? Like, I think that I like lost a little bit of faith in the movie to like handle this stuff in like a delicate, interesting way.
Oh,
and so
yeah. Yeah.
like, although the scene wasn't bad, I don't think I enjoyed it because I was just like, okay, like what's going to happen here? That's gonna
I just want to say that, like I said, as we were sort of coming up to this thing, I don't necessarily know that we needed this storyline. Like,
right.
I think to Kenny's point earlier, this real estate would have been better served building Stevie as the professional goals that Stevie has, the desire to get out of town if that's what he wants, the desire to be a professional hockey player if that's what he wants. That time would have been better suited, better used in that way than with this, especially since I don't think any of the premature ejaculation stuff that comes after this is worthy of anything. Like that all should have been literally thrown away. All those jokes make no sense. All that sort of post-concussion nonsense is just sort of like jokes for joke's sake. Bad, honestly, bad TV jokes. Like they don't even feel like they're just...
We talk a lot about movies that wouldn't get made these days.
Correct.
And
correct.
You know, in some respects, this falls into that. I could see a movie about this topic getting made.
Yeah.
But there's certain old-fashioned ideas in this movie that, and I don't mean old-fashioned, obviously, like the 50s. I mean old-fashioned, like the 90s, mm-hmm. that just wouldn't happen anymore. You wouldn't devote real estate to one of your main characters to a story that's essentially about if and when he's going to have sex in his life now that he's good at hockey. In this way, right? There are ways right. to tell that story.
Yeah.
You know, Friday Night Lights did it with Saracen in really like an incredible, beautiful way. that felt important. You know, it felt like an important life set for that character and kind of an important line in the conversation or the dialogue people have about high schoolers having sex. But this is just a joke. And in 99, I think that was okay. Like in 99, I think in a movie like this, ostensibly a serious movie with some comedic elements, you would devote probably four or five beats to this kind of story, but you would never waste your time with this shit these days. You know,
I mean, it's, and I'm not necessarily riding for really kind of anything that happens in the storyline. Yeah. I'm really more than anything just saying that I appreciated the kind of smallness of it, to Kenny's point, and the fact that it wouldn't exist today. I appreciated that it did in this movie, even if it's not executed particularly well. I would also say, too, you know, as much as I'm harping on stuff that – or we are harping on stuff that doesn't work, some stuff that does – there are some really beautiful lines in this movie that I really appreciated. One of my favorites was the line that Donna says to John when they're having their fight, and he's saying, you know, you're smiling at Hank Azaria in a way that you don't smile at me, whatever. And she says, everyone in this town peeks over the snowbank and wonders.
Yeah.
Is a great line. That to me is sort of, I one of the things, and this kind of comes into the storyline that we were talking about with Marla and Stevie, but like one of the things that I think this movie does well is doesn't make the sort of obvious binary small town arguments that so many movies tend to do, which is the whole like small town life versus big city life. I like that this movie doesn't try to make that argument necessarily. But I would also say, to talk into both sides of my mouth, but what I would also say is that it creates that muddiness that exists in this movie, which is that it's kind of all over the place and it doesn't crystallize what it's trying to say about small town life. Like, what is it trying to say about small town life? I really couldn't tell you, but
yeah. Well, and again, it like, it is a sort of like a compression factor because like, I agree that that's a good line and that's a good sort of like conversation or question about small time life or about life and about choices like to explore.
Right.
It's just deployed so quickly for that to be the third line in your argument with your, you know, husband is just like, well, I guess that's been in the chamber for like a really long time, which is its own, is like its own question, you know? And so it's like, this is like a really skilled outliner because, you know, even just going back to the reporter storyline, like it's like the thoughts were there. It's just done so quickly that it's more like a bullet points where it's like,
go ahead.
One other thing about this movie, and again, every movie doesn't have to be everything. This movie tries to be almost everything. So, you know, it's certainly not lacking in thematic ambition. However, it takes place in Atlanta. And one of the things that I have been told about it, I'm sorry, Alaska. One of the things I've been told about Alaska over and over again is how disproportionately male Alaska is. There is the show Men in Trees, and the joke is there are so many men, there are men in trees here.
Trees.
There was a season of, or there was a show called, I think, like Bachelorette in Alaska or something like that, where a woman just went to Alaska because there's so many men.
Well, Northern Exposure had like three female characters.
There is something that they could have done about the disproportionate ratio in Alaska. And I don't even think I don't even think it was cognizant that both of our major female characters were looking somewhere else. And I think that it's a little different than everywhere else where the ratio is basically 50-50. I think the ratio is like 5-1 in Alaska. And at that point, like, you know, I do think for heterosexual women in Alaska, it must be, I'm not saying better, worse, just different. Yeah. A different situation that there is something that you could discuss in this movie that you can't discuss in others that wasn't hit on.
To that point, we have to talk about Skank because I am sort of unclear. First of all, like Ron Eldred is fine. I don't.
He's an ER guy, like, right?
He is an ER guy. He was in a season of ER. He was great on ER.
Back when I watched.
Season two. So I think that the show. I think that he is a good actor. I don't love him, but he's fine. I think this character is half-baked at best. I get that he's sort of more of a punchline than he is anything else. But it seems as though his character's arc ends with a speech that he gives to the mayor that is deeply odd. Skank is having an affair. Skank works, he's a teacher at the school. And Lolita Davidovich is also a teacher there. She's married to the mayor. They're having an affair. And then in a really clunky moment, about halfway through the film, the mayor finds Skank's necklace and says, Skank has been in this bed. And then they have their scene.
It says Skank on it, right?
Sorry?
It says Skank on it, right?
Anyway. Long story short, end of the movie or before the big game, Skank knocks on the mayor's door to basically give him a speech about how much he respects the mayor and the town and the sport of hockey and that he's doing this for the mayor.
Well... it's not a good scene, but again, this is the thing where it's like it is trying to touch in a too fast way something that would be interesting, which is, you know, to me, the big part of that speech is when he's talking about he never really thinks about anything, and after hockey, he's just going to become a drunk like his dad. And so it's like this is, you know, again, like a sort of like a quintessential but interesting small town archetype of a character. I'm going nowhere, but I'm in the sort of height of my like perceived power. And, you know, I have no future. I'm just kind of living for today.
Yeah.
And to like sort of like bring that character in a kind of relation to a sort of like pillar of the community type is like interesting. It's just done. I don't even want to say weird.
No subtext.
Right.
Like the character is literally saying how he feels.
Right. And it's just a crazy way, like, to just go up to the guy and be like, you know, I'm sorry, but it's like, I'm going to try to win this game. Like, does that make it like, what are you doing? Are you drunk now?
I don't mean this drastically, though it will sound that way. That is the hallmark of middlebrow entertainment. The middlebrow entertainment is no subtext. Sure. That's it. Sure. And I love a lot of middlebrow stuff I would call middlebrow, like Shawshank Redemption. But that is what this is. This is not making you work very hard.
Right.
So, no,
that's true.
And this is probably off topic for the purposes here, but like, I think we could also reassess the importance of subtext and scene work as we, you know, as just humans become like more interested in articulating our kind of a specific experiences. Like
that's a really interesting point.
Like on the regular, you know, I am in on the nose conversations. Mm-hmm. Me and the people I know are constantly trying to articulate exactly what's happening, like in our backstory and connecting these moments. And so I guess it's just a footnote. Like, I think you are correct here. That's not a defense of the scene. It's just like,
to your point, Bart, I think that like theme is subtext, right? Like what the themes of whatever this thing is, I would argue, and I agree with you that characters don't necessarily need to be subtextually talking about things while talking about things. But sorry.
I would say, it's going to sound contrarian, your on the nose conversations have subtext.
It's a great point.
But I think you're right in like, because we sacrifice being intriguing and compelling sometimes for the sake of being subtle and nuanced, and what you wind up with is a boring scene. Yeah. That isn't engaging enough for people to even start to say, what is the scene actually about? So to your point, I think it's a really good move to go directly at the problem in a scene.
Yeah.
And also to say the reason that they're doing it this way and the reason that this is baked in here and you want to talk about your backstory because of this moment, like every decision you make, particularly connecting backstory, is informed by something you're trying to get across subtextually. So, mm-hmm. you know,
but I would, yeah, I agree with everything right. both of you are saying. And I do think, and I appreciate the idea of, in general, I love a writer, director, actor, whatever, going right at the
problem. So do I.
Right? Rather than the fucking, you know, all that shit. Totally. But in theory, that's a better... Like, this is just not executed well is what I'm getting at. Like, I don't think that this scene in particular that we're talking about with Skank going straight at it, I don't necessarily have a problem with what he's saying, more so of maybe how it's being executed. You know, there's just something about the scene that doesn't... Totally
I would say, that if you want to be very generous towards a scene, because I'm not saying it's there, but I'll be generous. It's interesting that Skank decided at this moment to be as empathetic as he could possibly be.
Yeah.
To almost put on a pair of glasses and say, you can't hit a man with glasses, right? At that moment. That says a lot to me about that character potentially. Again...
We could have used
a moment with Skank's dad or a moment with Skank's mom or a moment that hinted at what he's nervous about becoming without him just saying it. But as a tertiary character, it didn't fall flat to me. It felt kind of sad in a not horrible way.
And I would also say to your point about even when like subtext is being made text, they're still being subtext. It's like, you know, this scene, if you just have the mayor kind of reject him, you like a sort of get all of that where it's like in like trying to not become that guy in such a selfish way. You are that guy.
Yeah.
But I agree with everything you guys are saying.
That's too much for this movie, but you're right. Like I would,
yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
A step too far for this movie to go. It's just
right because this movie ends Skank's arc with him taking a puck into the balls.
Well, and then the reporter, right? Yeah. Yeah.
There it's you
not
go.
This movie. I mean,
Which feels like a nice metaphor for this film in general. But like, I mean, I agree. Like, I think that the weird part of all of this is like, I'm a big David E. Kelly fan. I really loved a lot of his television shows. I think he's a superb writer. I think that when he is clicking, there's really kind of no one like him. And he can do all the things we're talking about. We've seen him do it in his television shows, which is why... This is such a, again, another missed opportunity and just a whiff in a weird way.
Is this, I mean, like, I don't know, I haven't had time to really think out this case, but is this the smartest not good movie ever? Like, because, I mean, just the raw?
Yes,
it is. Because I mean, there are so it's many good ideas and, like, clearly David E. Kelly is, like, you know, like a good writer and... saw where the moves were, you know, like, like from a story standpoint and from like a thematic standpoint, because yeah, like almost every story point or scene that we're deconstructing and criticizing, it's like the ideas were there for him. They just weren't pulled through or set up. So it's like, he saw the moves.
They shot. I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously extrapolating, but it just feels like another writer would have taken another year on this, right? And really, really focused in on what every scene was about. David E. Kelly doesn't have to do that because David E. Kelly's first drafts are probably like my 50th drafts, right? He probably shits out producible material, which he kind of did here. But I do think that, like, to your point, Bart, there's so much here that could have been fine-tuned and sharpened and sculpted. And it would have been a really kind of potentially incredible movie that would have been timeless. It's funny because, like, I, as you know, I loved Lake Placid, and Lake Placid, part of it is Lake Placid is so much more David E. Kelly to me than this. Lake Placid, like, has his quirk and has his structure has his characters and has you know, like a very simple romance at the center of it that's not too complicated by anything else. Whereas this feels like he sat down to write a novel, but he wrote the novel in the same time he would write anything else. And there are some really interesting half-baked ideas here.
Can I also say that just to highlight the direction for a second here, because in my brain I was like, there are two directors that come to mind that would have, I think, directed this film better in the two modes that I think it exists in. I think there's a Tom McCarthy version of this where it's the small town character who Tom McCarthy can do comedy quite well, but like would understand how to kind of let everything just settle, allow these people to feel lived in. Which is something that Jay Roach at this point in his career clearly wasn't comfortable in doing. And then I think there's the Gavin O'Connor version of this where it's you hand it to someone who's going to fucking nail the hockey, who's going to nail that energy, who's going to bring that kind of, you know, blue collar kind of what have you into it that he did in Miracle. It's just Jay Roach is kind of neither fish nor fowl when it comes to this particular film. It just doesn't feel like, I'm not saying the script doesn't have problems. I think it does have problems, but I think that half of this film's problem is the execution of said script. And I do feel like Jay Roach is just not totally jiving with the material.
This is the first and only Jay Roach movie I've ever seen that is too that's problem is that it's too dense. And I don't mean that as an insult. Like he is really, really good at presenting a movie in a way that's digestible. True. And he's done it with so many different genres now. Like he is a really, really talented filmmaker, really talented commercial filmmaker. And there's just something about this that he didn't find that thing he can grasp.
Yeah, he's got a very Chris Columbus kind of vibe to him, and I don't say that in a shitty way. I think that Chris Columbus is another filmmaker who, you know, very successful, knows how to make a film that's going to hit with an audience. And I think to your point, Kenny, the script is trying to do so much. The script is too dense that it's just, I don't know. I just, there's a part of me that's like, I'm just so surprised by how flat this movie felt for me, considering all of the talent that's in this movie.
Is there any way, I don't even know if this is possible or if you guys could do it, is to contextualize how much, I don't know if power is the right word that a David E. Kelly would have. Like, what would his influence be? Because it's a 99. He's obviously a huge deal in television, but television to features is a very different thing.
Well, a lot of articles talked about with Lake Placid anyway, because there's not a ton of material on Mystery Alaska quite from the coop. But with Lake Placid, it was Steve Minear who directed Lake Placid, who was a TV director. So Lake Placid feels a lot more like a David E. Kelly vehicle that's directed by a guy who's directed episodes of his show before. And I think to Kenny's point earlier, I think that's why Lake Placid feels a little bit more of a piece than this does.
But. I know from someone who worked on Lake Placid that David E. Kelly was not particularly present.
Oh, interesting.
So gotcha. And this came after the podcast, but my understanding is he wasn't particularly present. My guess is two guesses. One is that he was more present here, and two is that David E. Kelly's power in the industry at that moment was probably such that he had the ability to kind of direct this. Direct the production. It's just a guess, but it's, you know, he was so important in Hollywood at that point.
And this, again, sort of, you know, to kind of come full circle, but this is something that should have been important to him. And I imagine was important to him. Hockey was a big deal to him. It was a big part of his life, which makes this.
So he's also the only named producer.
That's interesting.
So
that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's one of those things where my feeling is that this was, I can only assume, a passion project of sorts. You know, Jay Roach is coming off of the first Austin Powers. He has Austin Powers 2, which also came out in 99. So he's got those two films in 99. Jay Roach is sort of this up-and-coming filmmaker, or already there, I guess, depending on what genre you're talking about. I don't know. I there's a part of me that feels like this movie was a big deal. You know what I mean? And we're also talking about Disney at an interesting time. And in next week's episode, we'll be talking about another Disney film, which Disney is really kind of dealing with a very sort of, they don't really know what the live action space is for them at this particular moment. You're seeing a lot of, you know, Inspector Gadget. Next week, we're going to be doing My Favorite Martian. You're seeing them take a bunch of IP and trying to make them live action and hoping and spending a lot of money on these things and not particularly doing well with them. So they're kind of in this weird neither here nor there, which is, again, why this film being rated R is so baffling to me on a Disney property. Like, that's another thing that would never happen today. Like, Disney wouldn't put their name on something that is this much sex and swearing in it. So it's just, I think there's just a lot of things kind of weighing this movie down in weird ways.
I'll just say one other thing. It's pretty bullshitty. Please, it's pretty bullshitty, but I hate the title of this movie for this movie.
Really? You don't think it's a mystery?
I think it promises something. And I know this is so stupid, but like, I can't help myself. Like, I think it is trying to pull some of that Twin Peaks-y shit into a movie that doesn't call for any of it. Yeah. So like, this movie,
but that's Picket Fences.
Right. Well, kind of. I mean, Rome, right? I mean, like, Rome is not mystery. Do you know what I mean? Like, Rome, like,
yes.
Like, there are plenty of names you can give a town, a fictional town that evokes something. But why call the town mystery is a mystery to me. And then why call the film mystery is a mystery to me. And I think it promises something that the film wasn't even trying to deliver. I think it's loaded. Like, it reminds me of the show Erie, Indiana. Do you guys remember that?
Yes. Yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
spelled like the Erie, like the lake. There is precedence for a funny name of a town being emblematic of what that movie or show is thematically about. And I think that this is, I don't know, it's not a
there's
big
nothing
deal.
Mysterious about this
it's
movie.
It's not a big deal, but it's just kind of stupid. Like, if you're going to take, if you're going to use your title to evoke something that the movie's actually about.
I don't disagree with you. So should we rate this movie, Kenny?
Yeah. Can I just ask one fast question just because I need
Please.
To know?
I don't have any.
Which is just, even if it's just like a good or bad, the way that a Russell Crowe wins back his wife. Well, not.
Of course.
It's just like,
good.
Yeah, yeah.
Just good. Like a yay or nay.
Good.
Okay.
I vote good.
Wait, he wins her, but how do we feel he wins her back exactly?
Well, not wins her back, but he crosses out all the words from like a deer.
Yes, I do. I like that. I like that.
Good. Okay. Should have been so bad. Yeah. Played so well by Mary McCormick.
Yes. 100%.
Good.
Yeah. She's the one that saves it. What would have been a treacly shitty thing, she makes feel real.
Good for everybody for taking that.
How do you feel about it, Bart?
I don't know. I thought I was going insane when it was happening because it was like, you know, it was like,
yes,
because there was just like all the stuff was crossed out. And then I thought the message would be coherent.
Yeah, I know.
But then like, cause like, you know, it was like at some point I didn't write down all the words, but at some point I started jotting them down because it was like maximum
body.
It's okay though. It's okay though. I think the reason I loved it, and actually, like, now
maximum.
I think I love it.
Maximum.
It was Maximus. I think the reason I loved it was because, like, it is actually something that guy could do in the way it was done. Like, if it was cohesive, that would have been like, how long did you take on this one, buddy? But like, I think it was sweet. Like, I think it was sweet, and I really appreciated the way she played that. Like, she also thought it was sweet, because my wife would be like, that's it, we're divorced now.
Body maximum.
Yeah. Stamina. Yeah. Like,
yeah, it's, yeah.
I think it might be insane, but I don't know. But like, and like, I agree the performance. Yeah. It was just very confusing. Cause I was just like, what is happening? And then I was like, wait, is this good? And that's why, like, I kept trying to come back to it because I just really wanted.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. We kept going away from it. It's the best part.
No,
of
I do think that it's here's what's weird is that, and forgive me because the movie's kind of a blur, but they have their fight, right? Mm-hmm. Then they have their makeup scene where she sees the stuff crossed out, which is sort of like the Zodiac Killer, but we'll just put that aside. And then he goes outside to skate, and then they kind of wrestle and kiss, and it's kind of cute and whatever. So he wins her over, I'm assuming, with the crosswordy kind of thing. But I'm not sure what my takeaway is supposed to be really from the skating scene. Like, it's the
they're
I
back.
Don't know.
They're back.
They're back. They're good. Yeah. Okay.
Let's rate.
Well,
this
but
thing.
Also, it. I mean, it seemed like he went out to skate by himself, and then she came.
I think that's
like
right.
It didn't seem like they went to skate because he was like skating around the goal. So it was like in his head, he was like, "I did the thing. We're good. Now I've got to go."
I think
get my mind right skating, and she came out.
I think his thing was, I did the thing, and it's a little humiliating that I did the thing, and I kind of got to go and skate. Like,
is it that? Right. Is it that? Like, is it that it's like,
manly?
It's like, oh, the other guy's good with words. I'm not good with words. Here's my attempt to be good at words. And it's like a lot of effort, but maybe not great. Oh. But it's cute because he tried and he spent a lot of time.
Isn't it cute because he tried like, and he spent a lot of time? It's sweet.
Right. I mean,
it feels that way.
And right. And then he's like, this is what I'm good at. So it's like, I tried to do the thing I wasn't good at.
Yeah.
It's weird. Okay. It's weird. Sorry.
Yeah. No, no, no. Don't apologize. I'm glad you brought it back because this is. This movie is such a random assortment of things. Mm-hmm. That there's stuff in it that I completely like forgot about. Like when they make the guy naked skate around and slide into the fucking
That was bad. Yeah. And they made that guy do it because he was a snitch. Yeah. So, you know,
snitches get stitches.
Anti Me Too movement right there. Like it's I don't know. I'm excited to rate it. Very excited.
But then also, loyalty is never a question again. Like just to
correct.
Speak to like
correct.
How much, it, yes. like it's just a scatter shot. It's just like, that's it. That story's over now. We trust each other. It'll never be questioned again.
Yeah. So Bart, you haven't been on for a movie, but we do ratings on this podcast where we rate the film from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest, 50% being the threshold of recommend or not recommend. You saw the film in 99, correct? Or around 99? Or had you seen it before?
Okay. Yes, I had seen it before.
So we try to rank it three times. Kenny and I did not see it in 99. So you can rank it in 99, what you thought of it before the podcast, and what you thought of it after the podcast, if the podcast changed your thoughts on the film. You can chew on that for a second while we do ours, and you can think about that. So Kenny, I'll go first. As I mentioned, hadn't seen this in 99. I was perhaps unreasonably excited to see this film, which I don't think did this film any favors. So I came into this podcast giving it a 60.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I would recommend this film to a certain degree. I think, honestly, when it comes to like what works and what doesn't work, I think I'm at like a 60-40 in terms of working to not working. So that's kind of where I'm coming at it from a 60. After this podcast, I actually like it more than I did. So I'm at a 67 now.
You like it quite a bit.
I feel pretty good about it now.
You would recommend this?
yes, I would recommend this.
I would say you would overwhelmingly recommend it. Like
I would recommend this film for a couple reasons. And Bart, you might be the biggest reason why I've come around on it as much as I have. You really made me like Russell Crowe's performance, and you and Kenny both got me on board much more with the Burt Reynolds performance. So those two things, in my opinion, that plus like the kind of, you know, quirky, cute, small town, it all takes place in the snow and I love hockey, that's what gets me to 67.
So here's what's weird. I thought this whole movie podcast
podcast.
That it was kind of like Bart liked it the most, and then I was kind of like in the middle, and you liked it the least. That's clearly not what it was. I gave it a 39 before the podcast. And I said, it feels like a replacement level movie. Anyone can do it. Many have, and most are better. It is not an abomination or anything, but I've got to have standards.
Wow.
However.
Apparently I don't have any.
No. However, okay. I was going in the same direction as you. We spent almost 2 hours talking about all the ways this movie missed the mark and all the things that it did wrong and all the things that, you know, we didn't like about it. And all I feel now is so much more affection for this movie than I felt before this. Like, strong affection for this movie all of a sudden. Like, I realize all the things it did right. You know, we didn't talk about that a lot, but all the things it did right, like even like planting a lot of these ideas, I have more affection for the characters than I realized I did. I think the world was really well built out. I think that it's so hard to paint the canvas, you know, the simple stuff, the setting, the time, the tone, all that stuff, and make it a sandbox you actually want to play in. And I think that's my big takeaway, is that I actually want to play in the sandbox. I'm going a lot higher. I'm going from non-recommend to recommend. I'm going to give it a 56.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I think I'm going to give this the lowest score. Which is funny. But so
I thought you liked it the most. I didn't think you loved it, but I thought you liked it the most.
I had seen it in a 99. Yeah. My memory of having seen it was that, like, oh, it was good. I would have probably given it maybe like a 60, right? But before this rewatch, I would have given it like an 85. Because I went into this, I had created this sort of a mystery Alaska narrative in my head, because what I kind of remembered
that's
really
the mystery.
Most, was the scene that you talked about where his wife is like, you know, like all coaches say they enjoy coaching better. And he's like, well, because they have to. And I just kind of remember that scene. I was just like, this, like, there's something here. And I was like, this is going to be the sort of unexpected sleeper hit of the 99 podcast. Like, we are going to stumble into this gem of a movie where it's like in, like, you know, because like what felt like, well, this must be the last podcast, because they've done them all, if they've gotten to Mystery Alaska, nope, will turn out to be, and then it really didn't hold up, obviously. And so then, I guess after I watched it, it's hard because, you know, one is, I think that everyone should get to watch movies before they go on a podcast, because it is a really fun way to watch a movie, especially if you're watching it with somebody else. And I was watching it with Ashley. And so, like, just like getting to talk about it with that, even still coming out of it, probably more like a 35. And then post talking about it now, though, my affection for it has also grown. But I can't. It's 2 hours. It's 2 hours. Like, I'm just imagining someone sitting through this movie being like, Bart said I should watch this? Like, what? So it's like, I want to give it like a 49.99 with the little thing over the nine, so that you know it like keeps repeating that line. Like, it keeps repeating until infinity.
At
so
some point, you got to round up.
No, there's no around it. Don't round up. Unless the only way that you could, the only way that I would I'll recommend is really if you are interested in like structure, and because like I do think again the end works, and I don't think it just works because the end is well executed. I think that this movie's structure somehow lends itself to a momentum feeling, even if it's not earned, and that is worth studying. So if you, so as like a like your own self-guided master class, I would say this could be like a 65. Like, don't watch
this before
you watch Citizen Kane, you know, but like if you've done all that and you're looking for like a different thing, there is like, I might actually rewatch this movie just to sort of like try to figure out some of the.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I've said this on previous episodes and I'll say it again. My metric of recommendation kind of depends on the film a little bit. There are films that I would just outwardly go up to anyone in the world and say, you have to watch this movie. Now, if someone came to me and said, hey, I'm thinking about watching Mystery Alaska, I'd be like, listen, Russell Crowe and Burt Reynolds are really great in it. It's 2 hours. It doesn't all work. But if you know, I wouldn't say don't watch it. That's kind of where I'm coming from in terms of my recommendation of this film.
This is what I would say, because I don't think anyone's ever coming up to me and saying, should I watch Mystery Alaska? What might happen in my life is someone says, I'm thinking about watching a movie tonight. And I've watched all the hockey movies except, you know, do you have any other ideas? Except Mystery Alaska. You guys are going to get it. And I would be like, I'll be like, all right, well, Mystery Alaska, you know, it might be for you. You might like it. And I want to make one other point. That was a really bad point. I would strike that off of the record. I think there's something to the idea that your memory of the movie, Bart, and I don't know if exactly what you're saying, but the 85 thing kind of sticks with me, that in your head, it was a better movie than it was. Does that make sense? Like, there is value in the lasting memories being positive ones. And that's actually what I'm taking from this movie, which I did not expect. Like, this movie has left a positive impression on me. And same. I really am happy that we watched it, and particularly that we talked about it.
Can I ask a very quick question, Bart?
Please.
What did Ashley think of Mystery Alaska?
She did not think it was good. I would guess that she would put it at the 35. She did have an incredible observation that I do just want to share.
Please.
It made me really happy that we get to watch movies together sometimes, where at the end, I think it's the last shot, she just sort of casually was like, there's no way that you'd be able to bury a body in the middle of winter in Alaska.
Oh, that's a good point.
And so that, so then that led to a discussion of, yeah, like, do you think they're just stacking them up until like the first thaw? Like how, like how are you handling bodies?
God.
But I don't think she thought it was a good movie.
That is that's incredible. That is the best way to end this episode. Next week, we are doing, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing My Favorite Martian with Morgan Dameron is coming on. She's a writer, filmmaker, and friend of mine. She loved this movie as a kid, watched it, she said, innumerable times with her family. Hasn't watched it in probably 15 or 20 years, and I look forward to hearing what she thinks about it now.
I have a question about My Favorite Martian.
Please.
Is there a movie that we've done that you have had lower expectations for?
Yes.
Really?
Simon Says is the lowest I've ever gone into a film.
Yeah,
really.
That's fair.
But this, to your point, this is certainly of the studio movies that we are doing. Like this is Disney's reboot of a classic 50s sitcom that I know nothing about. That, like, I don't even know.
Nobody talks about
it. It doesn't exist.
In even bad terms, like all I know is that Christopher Lloyd is in it, and I've seen the trailer, and it looks very, very bad.
I've never seen the trailer. I just know the poster. The teaser poster was just like the little Martian helmet. This was also, we talked about this a little bit. I don't know when it was, Kenny. It was on another episode, I'm sure. But we talked about it, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this too, Bart. That moment when like all of the TV shows that our parents grew up on, that we were then sort of, or maybe I'm just reiterating something from the blank check.
We've recently talked about this too, but yeah.
But this idea of those sort of like old shows that then got replayed a bunch that we then saw as kids and then got turned into movies, but none of them are really successful. We talked about it because of Mod Squad, I think, because that was, we talked about it then. But like this, in this year, we have Mod Squad, we have Inspector Gadget, we have My Favorite Martian. Like, then in other years, obviously, you have your Starsky and Hutches and what have you. It was a very weird thing that didn't bear much fruit, and yet a lot of them got made.
Until 21 Jump Street.
And then, right. It's like, leave it to Lord and Miller to take Lego as well and turn that into, like, they're just
That's why they're geniuses. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever seen My Favorite Martian, Bart? I'm assuming not.
No.
Show or movie?
No, I don't even think I knew it was a show, but now I'm like, that sounds, I mean, that's crazy that was a show.
It was a show for I think like 10 seasons.
We missed.
Did I know that it was a show?
We missed Wild Wild West. To see how long that was rebooted as well.
Yes. No, for sure.
But that was a big hit, right?
Wild Wild West.
Wild Wild West. Was that not a big hit? I didn't make two of them.
No.
Oh, what am I thinking of?
Probably Independence Day.
So my favorite Martian.
that's always a safe bet. Yeah. That's why I gave this
ran for
an 85 before I watched it, was because I was just replaying Independence Day in my head.
But, here's what's amazing about My Favorite Martian, which did run for 100 episodes. It only ran for 3 seasons, which meant that one season had 32 episodes and one season had 38 episodes.
Wow.
So,
oh man.
38 episodes. Try to wrap your head around making 38 episodes of a television show. Bart, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So much fun.
Had a blast. We can't wait to have you back. Can we find something else for you to come on? Maybe something you haven't seen because we'd love to have you.
I would love to. I will watch anything.
Fantastic. Maybe even have you and Ashley on together for a movie or separate.
I would love that.
So thank you so much. And please rate, review, subscribe. Thank you to Ernie and Emilio for producing the podcast.
And Will today.
And Will today. My apologies. Will, of course. Thank you to Jan Katas for our theme song and our artwork. Please rate, review, subscribe. Thanks.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.